Oh, very good.
Hello?
Hello?
Guys, I just had a funeral, so it's Benny.
Oh, Benny, I just asked if you were there. I feel much better you're with us. Thanks, Benny.
Why?
Oh, you know why.
Funeral,
I really appreciate you being on here.
Anyway, I'm here.
Yeah, thank God. Thank God. I was starting to say that I like responses. That's why I don't like people to mute. And it really reminds, I mean, I was a spiritual leader for many years, and I gave many, many sermons. And I have to say that when I gave a sermon, there were places where there would be humor and so on, and that the response to humor was encouraging, you know. And there's nothing worse than getting up and thinking, you know, you're saying something funny and there's dead silence. I have to say that in delivering sermons, there were times when I thought there'd be laughter and there wasn't, and there were times I didn't know there'd be laughter and there was. So you never know the response. But last week, it was almost as if I was talking to myself, and that could be a little bit disconcerting. In any event, I was pleased with the response last week, and I always like to follow through. And I'd like to touch upon first a couple of things that we discussed last week. We discussed the tefillin, the whole point of the four compartments in the shel rosh, and then the, of course, the single parchment in shel yad, all containing the same four parshiot. And we also discussed I had said that the Torah gave the sages the authority to pass their own, you know, takanot and gezerot and all the different, you know, the mitzvot derabbanan. And I was called on it about where does this come from and so on. And I did a little bit extra research on that. So I'm going to touch upon these things. First, let me say this very interestingly. In the Talmud, and it's in the Masechta Yoma, which is, of course, for Yom Kippur, it says, Rava, the son of Huna, said, a man is obliged to touch his tefillin every hour. Now, if you heard this out of context, you say, a man is obliged to touch his tefillin every hour. So somebody, you know, the wise men of Chelm would say every hour they go to their tefillin and they touch it. But it didn't mean that at all, because in the days that this was written, the tefillin was worn all day. And this is what a lot of people don't understand today. When a man put his tefillin on, that was worn all day. And that's where the confusion comes. Tefillin is one mitzvah. Davening is another mitzvah. If you never daven, but you put tefillin on, you get rewarded for that mitzvah of the tefillin. I'll tell you another thing.
Richie, the tefillin, the tefillin of that day, they were soft, right? They were not talking about the same structured piece that we think of today.
They were similar, but what did you say? They were soft?
Yeah, my understanding is that the parchments were placed in a leather sack, and so that they were not, they didn't look like what we think of as tefillin. They were, you know, that it was an easier concept that you would be wearing them all day.
That could be, but
I don't remember where I got that.
I don't know. It had to be written on a cloth, that's for sure.
They didn't have to be in a box.
No, they didn't have to. Well, that's not necessarily, because it does say it had to be in four compartments on the head. How else would you put it if you didn't put it in a box?
I'm guessing
it had to be
in
four. I don't believe that it was that much different, but you can check on that. Nevertheless, the point was that the ikar here is the fact that they had to wear it all day, and therefore, Rava said he has his tefillin on all day, and therefore he has to touch his tefillin every hour. That's where that came in from. Now, I'll tell you another thing which is very interesting. The Shel Rosh, the Shel Yad is one mitzvah, and the Shel Rosh is another mitzvah. If we have time, well, I'm sure we're not going to have time after in five lessons, but if you want, let's say next year or whenever, I could give you a whole course on every single one of the 613 mitzvot as enumerated by the Rambam. But one, he makes a separate mitzvah for the Shel Rosh and a separate mitzvah for the Shel Yad. And of course, they wore it all day. And at that point, you'd say, well, how could they wear it all day? Because they used to sit and study all day. That's what they did. If they had to use the lavatory, then they had to take it off. And when they came back, they put it back on. And I recall in my yeshiva days, there were people there that studied perhaps 16 hours a day. They would get up, they'd go to the Beis Medrash, and they'd sit and study 16 hours a day, many times throughout the wee hours of the night. So if you stop and think of a person with that mentality, they have their tefillin on and so on. That was the way it was. Now, I want to get to something here which is very interesting, and then it'll lead to the tefillin. In the same Gemara, in Yoma, on 33a and B. So I'm going to read to you. And the removal of the ashes from the inner altar precedes the trimming of the five lamps. Why? Abaye said, I know it by tradition, but I do not know the reason. Rava said it is in accord with Reish Lakish, and one must not forego the occasion of performing a religious command. And as the Kohen enters the Heichal, the sanctuary, he comes first upon the altar. And it goes on to say what it was taught in the candlestick and this and that. Then it says, from what Reish Lakish said, we infer that it is forbidden to forego the arm in favor of the forehead. So what he's saying is, you can't reverse the order. You can't put on the Shel Rosh first and the Shel Yad. So what does this say? And by the way, and I'm sure Benny and others are aware, if you touch the Shel Rosh first, then you have to put it on first. But you're not, obviously you take caution and not to touch it when you go and you take the Shel Yad. So from the I have a question?
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
In my tradition, if you take out the Rosh first,
yeah,
by mistake,
you kiss
it and you put it under the cover, like the challah, shouldn't be embarrassed, and then you go to the challah cover, and then you go to the Yad.
Interesting, because Benny, that's a very interesting, and to me that would make more sense. But it actually says, if you touch the Shel Rosh, you should put it on first. But again, this is minhag. I mean, what you're saying, it makes much more sense than that. But here it says, from the arm, it shall proceed to the forehead. How do we know that? Because if you look at the way it reads, it says, you shall bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be for frontlets between thine eyes. Rava's remark applied to the obligation to touch the tefillin. Now, why does he say touch the tefillin every hour? This will keep your mind on pure thoughts and so on. So it keeps you in a prayerful mood. Now, here's the interesting thing, and the thing I learned last week when Benny said about the four compartments, the four senses, and everything else we said, I'm going to give you an entirely new reason, which is in the Gemara and so on, which is very fascinating. And I have to say, I learned it as a teenager, and I remembered it, but I didn't apply it to the fact of the four compartments. So what am I talking about? It says, Ukshartam os al yodecho v'hoyu l'totafos b'neinecho. And you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. These are the tefillin. But the interesting thing is, it says la'ot, which is singular, and on the arm, on the hand, on the arm. And since it is singular, and then it says ukshatam, and then you shall bind it for a sign. The sign is singular. As a result of that, that's where the Talmud says you get one parchment. It's one, and you have the four different parshiot on that one parchment. But then it says, so here's what they say. It's very interesting. And Rashi brings this out. Because tot tafot comes from the word tot and fot. And in African dialects, tot means two and fot means two. So therefore they say, and this is in, also in the Talmud Sanhedrin, and it's in several. As a result of that, the two and two is four. And because of that, that's where they get the four compartments. To me, it sounded a little far-fetched, but that's exactly what is stated there. Now, the question is asked, hasn't it been taught that Lotot Tafot occurs three times in the Torah? Now, listen to this one. Twice defective and once plane. That means the chaser male. In other words, Tot Tafot is spelled two different ways. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you.
Yeah, with or without the vav.
With, well, both ways.
With or without, right? Without the vav.
Right. Without, it's spelled in two different, it's spelled in different places according, in other words, with the vav in two places and without the vav in one place. So here's what they say, but this is when it becomes very interesting. It says, according to this, according to the Talmud, it says the opinion of Rabbi Ishmael says that it's spelled defective without the vav two times, and with the vav one time. So what they say is, that's what Rabbi Ishmael says. Rabbi Akiva maintains that there's no need of the interpretation. He's saying that this two times defective and once full, and the full is plural, so it's the way he's making it sound, it implies four. But in reality, it is disputable. This whole thing is very controversial, because if you look in our version, it's only spelled without the vav once. So here, let me make this a little clearer. The rabbis taught it is written Lotot Tafot once with two different spellings. So the word occurs three times in the Torah, according to this, twice in Devarim, chapter 6, verse 8, and then chapter 11, verse 18. It is defectively written. Defectively means without the vav, or chaser. It's written without the vav, so that in each instance the word might be read in the singular. That's what it's saying. And once in Shmot, it's written in the plural, which indicates the plural. Anything in, they say, plural is two, because it's more than one. So thus, according to this, it makes a total of four. He's saying it's written two times defectively and once full, which is plural, and then, okay. But here's the problem. If you look in our Torah, in our Chumash, it's not spelled defectively twice. It's only spelled defectively once. So it doesn't even agree with the Masoretic text, because that's the problem, that you even have different spellings and different versions. So in our text, Lotot Tafot, the defective way is spelled only one time. It's spelled without the vav. And if you look, you'll see in Devarim chapter 6, verse 8. And you know where it's spelled defectively? In the Shema. Now, if you remember, when you do the Shema every day, just you'll notice that Lotot Tafot is spelled without the vav. On the other hand, if you look in the V'hayayim Shamoa, it's spelled with the vav. So the minutiae here, but you should be aware that it's spelled two different ways. Now, here comes the interesting part. The rabbis taught, how must one write them? Now, according to halacha, this is very interesting, and this is something most people don't know. Any sofer would know. But according to halacha, the tefillin has to be written, they have to be written in exact order. You have the partio, it has to be written in exact order. Now, what does that mean? So let's say they're writing it and v'ahavta, and then he makes a mistake on the last letter or the next to the last letter of the v'ahavta, and then he erases it. He can correct it. But let's say he starts and he misses a word. Let's say he goes v'ahavta et, and he forgets et, and he continues on. It's too late. He can't. It's pasul. He cannot use it. You can't use it. It's not kosher. Now, the question is, how would you know this? You wouldn't know it. That's the whole point. So you have to have a sofer that you trust and that who knows. He also knows the law. Now, here's a very interesting story. There was somebody that went to the Vilna Gaon, and it may not have been the Vilna Gaon. I think it was, but it was some well-known Rav. And he went to him with a problem, he was having some problem, some issue. And the Vilna Gaon told him, go have your tefillin checked. Now, what that means is he's telling him, as a result of puzzle tefillin that aren't kosher, you're probably having this issue. He went to the sofer. He had it checked. The sofer said, it's fine. And he went back to the rabbi, and he said to him, I just had it checked. You said to have it checked. It's fine. So what should I do now? He said, go back and have it checked again. And this happened three times. When he came back the third time and told him, the Vilna Gaon said, go to the sofer who wrote it and ask him what order he wrote it in. And it's a phenomenal story. It's not it actually happened. So he goes back and he asks the sofer that wrote it and he said, did you write it in exact order? And the sofer said, no, I missed something. And that was it. Obviously the sofer didn't know that halach. He went back and that was the outcome of that story. So it has to be in exact order. Now, I would expect somebody to ask me a question.
This is Teddy Myers, and I have a question because there's two different traditions, according to, from my understanding, the way the
Rabbeinu Tam and so on. We're not talking about that.
Okay.
That's something
okay.
else. I understand what you're saying. If it's a Rabbeinu Tam, in other words, whatever they decide they want, let's say they want Rabbeinu Tam, which means is a change in the order of the Parshiot, that's fine. But that has to be done in order.
Right.
It has to be done in order according to whatever your minhag is. But what I'm saying is, once you establish that you're going to use whatever you're going to use, it has to be in that order. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. What's the second question? The second question I thought would be the first question. You said you had another question?
No, that was it. That was it.
Oh, okay. I thought someone's going to say, well, what about the Torah? I mean, the sofer spends an awful long time on the Torah. The answer is it does not apply to the Torah. And I would say my gut feeling is it doesn't apply to the Torah because it would become impossible. I mean, they make mistakes, they forget this and that. So to make a Torah puzzle would be very costly. But the fact is that it does apply to tefillin. Now, I'm going to get to something here. If you look at Parshas Bo, when Shemot, chapter 13, verse 16, does anybody remember how Yodcha is spelled?
What's the reference again? I'm sorry.
It's Shemot, chapter 13, verse 16. It's Parshas Bo, and it also has, you know, about the tefillin, and the word yadcha,
yeah.
Yadcha is spelled, anybody know how it's spelled?
Yud-Dalet-Chaf-Hey.
That's right. Yud-Dalet-Chaf-Hey. That's an unusual spelling.
Yeah.
Okay, because the ordinary spelling is Yud-Dalet-Chaf, Chaf-Sofit. Now, Rashi says, it may not be Rashi, but I think Rashi is the one that says that this alludes to the word keha, get a load of this, which is spelled kof hey, hey. The last hey is silent. When that means weak. And this teaches that the tefillin should be worn on the weaker arm. Very interesting. Worn on the weaker arm, and which is in most cases the left arm. However, if somebody is a lefty, they would wear the tefillin on the right arm. Now, interestingly, have you ever seen in let's say, a shachrit, when they're doing Vayomer David, and, you know, you put your head in your arm, what arm do you put the head in?
The one not wearing the tefillin.
That's right. But let's say this is done at mincha time. Then what arm do you put it in?
The weak arm.
The weaker. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but you can't do it when you're wearing tefillin out of respect for the tefillin. That'll bring to mind because it made me think. There are several different postures when you daven. Now, everyone thinks of two. We think of sitting and standing, but there's actually four. There's standing, there's sitting, there's the Vayomer David, there's where you put your head in your arm, and what's the fourth one? When you fall Korim. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Is that, yeah.
When you fall Korim, right. And I'll tell you, this is something I'm sure most of you are aware of, and I always found it very fascinating. In the Beis HaMikdash, the Talmud says when they fell Korim. Now, logistically, there wasn't enough room. If everybody prostrated themselves, there wasn't enough room. What does the Talmud say happened? Benny, you must have heard this.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Okay,
wasn't
what happened?
About the walls expanded or something like that?
Everything expanded. The floor expanded to make enough room. So I would think the modern version is in a lot of synagogues, when it's Rosh Hashanah, they expand, they take the doors and they open the door. So, I mean, if they can do it there, God could do it. But in any event, I'm sorry?
My face doesn't fall down because there will be 20 doctors on the bima if I fall down.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, Benny. And this is very interesting. When the chazan falls Korim, or the rabbi falls Korim, in the old, and I'm sure you have it, Benny, you have two people, one on each side, pick you up, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, people have said, that's ridiculous, especially me. I mean, I'm fit, Benny's fit, and so on. I don't need anybody to help pick me up. Why do they do that? Anybody know? And it's not because they're trying to be nice and help you. I'm going to tell you the reason. It's a very fascinating reason. When you daven the Amida, I'm sorry?
I was just thinking, does it have anything to do with service like in the temple? Is it related to temple service that people had jobs? And
not
that
at
was
all.
One of
no,
okay.
No. Their
is it
job
because
is,
your ankles are together during the whole time?
Exactly. And when you daven, you're not supposed to separate your feet
your ankles,
together.
Your knees, right?
Your ankles are, you're correct. It's your ankles.
Yeah.
They have to be together. But, you know, when you do it, you put both the together. So if you are doing it, if you stop and think of it, there's no way you could fall Korim with your ankles together and then get up without help. That's the only reason they help you.
This is very interesting. I would respectfully beg to differ because I've been able to do it and I was taught how to do it and I know other chazanim who taught me who know how to do it. So
how do you do it? Tell me. I'd love to know.
I mean,
who's talking now?
You just keep your legs together and I'm able to do it.
Who's talking?
This is Linda Sue Sohn.
Oh, Linda.
And, yeah.
If you can, you certainly, not only you can beg to differ, if you're able to do it, you're absolutely correct. I'm thinking, though, first of all, you have to be pretty acrobatic. How do you do it? When you say you're able to do it, do you use your hand to help you up? Can you do it without using your hand?
Can I get up without using my hands?
Yeah.
Well, no, but... you know, even still, I mean, if somebody were
not
helping you, it's the same as using your hands. But I definitely keep my feet together. I don't put my hands on my feet to keep my feet together.
No, I understand. But it's, I'm impressed if you can do it. You have to be in, you have to have very good, you must be, what is it,
I'm pretty limber and I'm pretty athletic and I'm able to do it. And
right.
I was taught, I mean, I have, you know, Chazanim who taught me, I went to school at Hebrew College and this is where I was taught to do it. I was shown and they said, this is how you do it. And so I said, okay, I can do that. And
that's
and
great.
They also acknowledge that if you can't, that there's nothing wrong with having somebody help you. And
no, I never said there was.
Right.
I just explained why.
Yeah.
By the way, do you do yoga?
I don't. I don't.
No?
But I have a farm. I do a lot of farm work, so that's kind of how, you know.
Oh, that's
this
good.
Is Naomi Hirsch, and I attribute my ability to doing it to having watched my husband growing up and to doing yoga. And once I push off the floor, I don't touch the floor again.
Exactly.
But I will say to any of you who are slight and don't weigh much, it's important to know who's picking you up, because I had the experience once where I followed a very heavy man, and when I was picked up off the floor with my feet literally off the floor, and now I tell them that they can be there, you know, ceremonially, but I'll handle it because I don't want to be flying.
Right.
I'll tell you something interesting, and if you didn't say that, I would never have remembered this. It's very, very interesting. In my yeshiva days on Simchas Torah, and of course in Simchas Torah, everyone lets their hair down, even to the most frum. So Rosh Yeshiva was the shatz. He was a shliach tzibur, and he was doing the musaf, the chazar for the musaf amida, and we picked him up into the air as he was doing it. And it was the funniest thing. I'll never forget that. So when you just said that, it reminded me. We did. We picked him up as if you'd pick up a chassan during a wedding. And he kept davening, and it was a sight to behold. But the other thing I do remember, somebody picking me up, and my gown went, wow. He tore the gown. So you're absolutely right. You have to be careful.
Okay, can I break in here with a question about something, please?
Yeah, certainly. You are?
Okay.
Neil?
This is Neil. Neil.
Yes, oh, Neil, go ahead.
Okay. I spent 13 years working with a rabbi who had some, shall we say, idiosyncratic ways of doing things and was very insistent that I do things exactly as he did. He did his Koreim the way the Arabs pray, with the tushy up in the air, whereas the entire rest of my career I've laid myself flat out on the bima, and I was so uncomfortable with the idea of sticking my tushy out at the congregation that I maneuvered myself before Muslim started so that I was kind of hidden a little bit behind the bima. The tushy part of me was hidden behind the bima, and I'm just curious whether colleagues have had that experience of the interpretation of Koreim being the way Arabs pray with their, you know, basically their shoulders on the ground, but their tushies up in the air.
Yeah.
Well, your rabbi was probably making a statement. nobody got that.
This is Linda anyway. Sue, and I was one of my teachers at Hebrew College is Cantor Brian Mayer, and in fact, he does just that you described, Neil. And
really?
Yes.
Neil, did you say you sprawl out completely on the floor?
No. He only goes down to his knees. There's only one time that he goes fully out.
That's what I'm saying.
You know,
yeah.
Flat on the ground, for Elaine, I think there's a difference between.
He does it for the great Alenu.
He does it for the great
Alenu,
but there are other places where you're falling Koreim, and for those...
Yeah, the three Bia Koreims.
Right. And for those, he does not go flat out. He only
No, I understand.
He only goes down to his, you know, to his knees, and he puts his head on his hands on the floor.
I've never seen anyone go flat out in all my years. Is there
really?
Benny, do you go flat out?
No, I told you before, sarcastically, that we don't. My rabbis wouldn't allow it, and every year I bow down more and more. And one day, my rabbi, who's no longer anymore there, because he got a sabbatical for 3 years, $1 million to get out of the goddamn place. So he said, I almost picked you up from the floor. I said, you don't have to, because I can get up myself. Anyway, what does that have to do with halacha?
What is that? You mean what they're saying now?
No, they saw this whole thesis or this, you know, about falling down.
Nothing.
It was one of the four positions for prayer. That's how we got into it. And this
I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have a question I really want to know. I would apologize to Benny if it's not strict halacha, but or halacha, but
I say halacha too. Go ahead.
I was taught to bend my knees on Kor'im, and I see so many people bending on Va'anachnu. And
here's the thing, and this is the halacha which most people don't know. We say Va'anachnu. First of all, you don't do it on Va'anachnu. You do it on Kor'im. You bend your knees. Va'anachnu Kor'im, and then are you talking about on when you prostrate yourself altogether?
I'm just talking about regular weekly Aleinu, and
you bend your knees at Kor'im,
and
then you bow on Umishtachavim.
Right.
And then the interesting thing is,
is this written anywhere?
Yes, absolutely. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. But I'll tell you another thing that's written, and if, again, I like these questions because it stimulates another thought that I wouldn't have thought of. In the Amida, the first two and the last two, Baruch, you bend your knees, Atah, you bow, you must be upright, totally erect at Adonai. Did you know that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people don't know that. Now, in answer to your question, the Aleinu, that's what you do. Now, here's something most people don't know. It's also in the Shulchan Aruch. And Modim Anachnu Loch, you're not supposed to bend your knees. You're supposed to just bow. But that's something a lot of people don't know, and you'd have to see it. And I was surprised when I learned that. A few years ago I saw it, and it was interesting. But most people do bend their knees at Modim and then bow. But in answer to the Aleinu, Va'anachnu, bend your knees at Kor'im, and then you bow at Mishtachavim. Is that how you do it, Benny?
Yep.
Yeah, that's how it is.
Richie, the answer for the not bowing, not bending
your knees at
Modim. You're not doing it is etymological. The word berach is the shorash of the word baruch, and berach means knee. So that when you do Modim, there's no better.
That's an excellent, probably that's excellent, excellent, very, very perspicacious. I think you're right. So we now go to something that, this is something also a tidbit that we're talking, as long as we're talking about unusual spellings like the Yotcha, when we do the Shema, we say Bechol Levavcha. That's not how you would spell Levavcha. That's not how you would spell your heart. It's spelled with two bases. Did you know that? That's not the real spelling of it. So then the question comes is, why is it Levavcha? Why is it two bases? Does anybody ever hear the answer? Fascinating answer. Fascinating. The answer is it's related to the psychological concept of sublimation. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with both the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. And that has always been a very fascinating concept to me, that you take every ounce of you, including your Yetzer Hara, and that's how you love God. And of course, by doing that, you're fulfilling a lot. Now, the second thing there was a lot of talk about was, where do we get this thing with that we have to listen to the Rabbanan and so on and so forth? And a couple of people did bring out the source. And I'm going to read it to you. This is from Devarim, and it's chapter 17, from verse 8 through 13, and I will read it to you. Let me just get the page here, 17. I thought I had it. It says, if a matter comes to you in judgment, and then let me just, I have the page. I can't believe it. 17. Okay. Here it is. Okay. Here's the verse. 8. Verse 8. If a matter of judgment is hidden from you, between, you know, Dhamma, between blood and blood, verdict and so on and so on, you shall rise up and ascend to the place that the Lord your God shall choose. You shall come to the Kohanim, the Levim, and to the judge who will be in those days. You shall inquire, and they will tell you the word of judgment. You shall do according to the word that they will tell you from that place that God will choose, and you shall be careful to do according to everything that they will teach you. And then it says, according to the teaching that they will teach you, and according to the judgment that they will say to you, shall you do. And then you shall not deviate from the word that they will tell you right or left. And the man that will act with willfulness, not listening to the Kohen, who stands there to serve the Lord your God or to the judge, that man shall die, and you shall destroy the evil from among Israel. The entire nation shall listen and fear, and they shall not act willfully anymore. So that's where it comes from. There was a big debate we had last week because a couple of people said they never heard that, and so on. But that's where the extrapolation comes, right from there. And any more comments on that? Because I had a lot of discussion on that last week. All right. Now I'm going to start the new stuff. I had mentioned, and this is something. This is like an aha experience. I had mentioned that there was a statement, and you've all heard of the statement that he who runs after honor flees from him, and he who runs away from honor. Overtakes him. He's overtaken by the honor. Have you all heard that?
No.
Okay, that's a famous proverb. People think it's in Pirkei Avos, but there's something similar in Pirkei Avos. Okay, let me start here. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was the man. Was that man? He said, "Man should always choose the way which is an honor to him and gets him honor from men." That's in Avos. Chapter 2, verse 1. While Ben Zoma said, "Who is honored? He who honors others." So one had to, and Bava Metzia, the Talmud 59a, said one had to show honor to one's wife. Now get a load of this. One had to show honor to one's wife and even to one's divorced wife. Imagine the thing. Yeah, this is the only time I got a laugh. Now, honor had always to be given, never demanded. And here the Talmud said the pursuit of personal honor takes a man out of the world, and one should always shun it. So the maxim, the proverbs, and he who runs after honor flees from him, while he who flees from honor is overtaken. Honor is overtaken by. In other words, so. That on the surface sounds, that's nice. If somebody's humble and they're not looking for honor, if they run away from honor, then they'll get the honor. Now, stop and think of it. If somebody legitimately is running away from honor, and then it says honor will overtake him, that's not a good thing. He doesn't want honor. It's a punishment. And this is something that it really is enlightening if you stop and think of it. If the proverb sounds like if somebody wants honor, they're not going to get it, but if they're real nice and they're humble and they run away from it, then they'll get the honor. But the whole point is they don't want the honor. And that's the thing, that's the aha experience. So then the question is, then, why would a person who doesn't want honor get honor? Why is he being punished? Anybody have any suggestions?
I don't know in biblical or Talmudic times, but these days people are often honored because they have money, and they might not want to, but they get to be the Israel Bonds award person, and they don't want that attention necessarily, but they're roped into it.
Well, that's one thing. But the other thing, the answer that's given is it's very interesting. The answer that's given, but that's a good answer, Yosem. The answer that's given is that if a person runs away from honor, it's almost done tongue-in-cheek. And that could go along the same line of what you're saying, that someone has a lot of money. You're saying, well, they don't want honor. But nevertheless, if somebody really didn't want honor, they had a lot of money, they would give everything anonymously. So then they wouldn't be honored. It's a very interesting concept. But if you stop and think of it, if you don't think of it in that way, you think if somebody doesn't want honor, runs away from honor, honor will overtake them. You think, oh, that's really nice. But the whole point is it isn't, because they don't want that. On the other hand,
this is Linda Sue, and I guess my take on it is it's similar to the concept of respect. Respect is earned. You really can't demand respect of others. You have to, it's through your deeds that.
Yeah, right. But what it's saying, you're absolutely right. But what it's saying here is that's different, because respect is something that is not. The honor is a little bit different. What it's saying here is that the person doesn't even want the honor. You're not going to say a person doesn't want respect.
I don't think that the adage is really saying that, though. If you're pursuing honor, you know, you're doing something for the sake of being honored for the deed, you know, then you're not going to achieve your goal. But it's not that there's nothing in the adage that says that he doesn't want the honor. It's just that he's saying that the person is not doing the deed in order for the honor.
But that's the
whole
point.
There's nothing about wanting or not wanting the honor in the adage.
But that's the whole point. What you said is that's what most people think. But if you go deeper and analyze it, if he's running away from honor, he doesn't want it. That's the point. You're saying, that's not true. It's saying it. If he runs away from honor, then honor pursues him. It's something he doesn't want. And what they're saying is that the person supposedly who's running away from honor is looking back. He's turning around. See, what you're saying is true, but in the real sense, if you analyze it, if a person runs away from honor, he doesn't want the honor. I can tell you, working with the police department, there was one police officer just retired. He was 40 years with the police, by 65 years old. He's a sergeant. There's no way he would have allowed anybody to have a party or anything. A lot of people, after 40 years, they make a party. He absolutely wouldn't have it. And there was no way he would have it, and he made that very clear. But there are very few people like that. In most cases, you know, they make a party for you. But if somebody, let's say somebody says, let's say somebody didn't really like this person, and they weren't going to make a party for him. Then he says, well, you know, I don't want a party. I don't think I should have a party. They may make a party for him because he gave them the idea. But it's just something to think about. I don't want to spend too much time on that, any more time on that.
You also have to think about why they're running away from the honor. Sometimes if you're a big donor, you don't want to be honored because you don't want everybody and their brother asking you to donate to other things as well.
It may not necessarily
be from a standpoint of being humble, but of just not wanting, you know, all the attention for other reasons.
That's true. That reminds me of the saying, your modesty is humiliating. But anyway, someone else was going to say something?
Yes, I was going to say to you that I look at it the other way around. When I was a child in my former life, I remember one student tells my teacher, מי שרודף אחרי הכבוד, הכבוד בורח ממנו. He who runs after כבוד, the honor runs away from him.
Right. That was the first part of what I said, Benny. That use the word pursue. That's right. But let me ask you, Benny, if somebody on the Lehefach, if somebody doesn't want the honor and they get it, Do you consider that to be something that they really wanted? I mean, if they're running away from it, they don't want it.
Well,
do you know what I'm saying?
I think if somebody wants to bestow honor on somebody and the person doesn't want it, he should accept it graciously. And as my rabbi used to tell me always when I was humbling myself, so small, you're not so big.
Right. That's, Benny, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, that's a story. The rabbi, the chazan, and the shamus, you know, oh, Lord, I'm so humble. And the chazan, Lord, I'm so humble. And then the shamus, Lord, I'm so humble. And the rabbi says to the chazan, look who thinks he's so humble, you know. But you're right. It's you're absolutely right. It's something you should be gracious and accept, because you know, they're being nice. You know, you don't kick a gift horse in the mouth. Is sort of that type of thing. Now,
yeah,
I'm going to give you a. Go ahead.
Liberty,
I'm sorry.
If somebody donates a lot of money or is doing it, you know, a mitzvah and doesn't want to be rewarded, you have to respect that if he wants to be anonymous.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you an interesting thing. One of the members of my former congregation, and I'm still very friendly with him and his family, he was a dean of Brown Medical School. He also was the recipient of the International Award, the Nobel Peace Prize. Very, very great man. But as great as he is, he's even more humble. Now, there was a housing development in Fall River, and they wanted to name it after him. And he refused. I don't want it named after me. And, of course, they honored that wish, and they named it after a cardinal. Cardinal, I don't know what the offhand, I can't even think of the name, but it's a housing development in Fall River. It turned out to be, it was originally for senior citizens, people that were old and maybe didn't have that much money, but it was originally for something very, very nice. And this turned into a den of a drug den and all kinds of stuff. And when I saw him, you know, a little time after that, I said, I bet you you're happy they never named that. I bet you're happy you didn't allow them to name it. He laughed, which is true, because it's a terrible place. And so he didn't want the honor, and it ended up he was rewarded for it. Now, I'm going to go to a fact here that will surprise most of you. And according to some Talmudic authorities, this is really going to shock most of you. And this is from the, you can check in Pesachim, you can check in the Gemara, the Pesachim, Daf 79b. According to some Talmudic authorities, women were counted in the minyan for offering the Korban Pesach. And this was Rav Kahana, and they were actually, now we talk about egalitarian and so on, for the Korban Pesach, for that particular thing, women were counted by some, and we're talking, these are very traditional scholars, they were counted in the minyan. Now, I'll give you the probable practical reason. So while the required quorum for most activities requiring, of course, a minyan is usually 10, it isn't not necessarily that way always. For example, the Pesach Korban from the day, or the Korban Pesach from the days of the Beis HaMikdash, it had to be offered before, does anybody know how many people? 30. That was the quorum. It wasn't the minyan of 10. It had to be 30. So the reason is it said it must be performed in front of the Kahal Adat Yisrael, the assembly of the congregation of Israel. And listen to how they derive 30. Kahal Adat Yisrael. So 10 are needed for the Kahal. 10 for the Adat, and 10 for Yisrael. That's how they got 30, and therefore it's my no one else that I know ever said this that I studied, but my feeling was 30 was a lot, and therefore so they bent the rules a little, and they would count women for that minion of Shloshim of 30. So now I'm going to start to discuss the principles. We don't have that much time, so I'm going to try to give you the introduction, and we'll continue with it next week. The principles, there's 14 principles to be relied upon in enumerating the mitzvot. And I have to mention, of course, that the total number of mitzvot is 613, and I went through this last week, so I'm not going to say the breakdown, of course, was 248 and 365. If there's anybody here that wasn't on the class last week and you want to, I'd be happy to stay after 5. I did last week. I stayed till, I think, 5:30, and I'll be happy to stay to as long as you want. So the whole thing was, you know, that there was that 613. They were totally mistaken in what goes into the list, as I will explain in this work. Now, the reason for this error was because they didn't know the 14 principles that now I'm going to explain. I'll start with a few of principles, and then we'll continue with that. There was the commandment, the commandments of the rabbinic origin. In other words, the Doraita, and these are not counted. So this rule excludes the lighting the candles on Hanukkah and reading the Megillah. In fact, you pointed that, Benny, the Megillas Esther on Purim and so on. That's principle number one. Principle number two is the commandments that were derived using the... Yes?
Oh, I'm so sorry. You said Doraita. Isn't that the Rabbanan?
What?
Isn't that the Rabbanan, not Doraita?
If I said Doraita, you're absolutely right. I meant the Rabbanan. Did I say Doraita?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's the Rabbanan. Thank you. And if I make a mistake like that, that's just, you know, that's like a typo. Of course, it's the Rabbanan.
Sure, I understand.
No, please. If I do that, I definitely want to be corrected, and it shows me you're listening. Now, these mitzvot that were derived using the 13, we call the hermeneutic rules, the Rabbi Ishmael's rules, and these are not counted. So this rule excludes reverence for Torah scholars, which Rabbi Akiva derived from the verse, you must revere the Lord your God. Now, principle number three, and a lot of this will get clearer as I go on. And three is, do not count mitzvot which are not binding on all generations. That's very interesting, because there are mitzvot that are not historically permanent. These are not counted. So this rule, however, excludes the prohibition that the Levim, 50 years or older, may not serve in the tabernacle. Number four, do not count the mitzvot that cover all the mitzvot. What does that mean? In other words, there's commandments that encompass the entire Torah. These aren't counted. That's not part of the Taryag. But then it says this rule excludes the command to keep everything that I have instructed you. Okay, that would be an exclusion. Number five, do not count the reason for a mitzvah as the actual mitzvah. That's very interesting, because the reason for a mitzvah is not counted as a separate commandment. For instance, the Torah forbids, you may not know this, but the Torah forbids a wife to remarry her first husband after she has married a second husband. Okay, the Torah then adds, and do not bring guilt upon the land. This is the way it explained it. So this last statement is a reason that explains the preceding prohibition. I don't know why it is, but that's a reason. And it's so, therefore, it's saying you're not to count that separately. Now, the sixth principle is for a commandment with both positive and negative components. And I'm going to explain what that means. The positive component counts as a positive instruction, while the negative component counts as a negative prohibition. For example, The Torah commands that you have to rest on Shabbos, and it forbids against doing work on that day. Two different things. So resting counts as a positive instruction, and working counts as a negative prohibition. Another one, the Torah says you're to eat matzah. You have to eat matzah on Pesach, at least during the Siddurim, during the Seder. You have to eat matzah, and then what does it say? Don't eat chametz. So you might say, if it says eat matzah, well, that would mean don't eat chametz. Not necessarily, but even if it did, that counts as two mitzvot. And I'm going to conclude today with number seven. And number seven is the details of a commandment that define how it applies are not counted. The details, and I'm giving you an example. The Torah commands certain sinners to bring an animal sin offering. If they cannot afford it, what do they bring instead? Two birds. And if they can't afford the birds, what do they bring? A flower offering, mincha offering. And that's right from the Torah in Leviticus chapter 5. Vayikra. So, what were you saying? I'm sorry?
No, I said Vayikra, yes. Thanks,
yeah, in Vayikra chapter, fifth chapter. Thus, a wealthy sinner sacrifices an animal, but a destitute sinner brings a flower offering. And this type of variable sin offering is the Korban Ole V'Yored, you know, counts as one commandment, even though it includes three different scenarios. You get it? The three different scenarios depend upon the financial standing of the person. So it could be so the Torah is saying people bring an animal sin offering, or two birds, or a flower, that's still one commandment, even though it includes three different scenarios, depending on the wealth of the sinner. So what it's saying is, do not count the details of a mitzvah themselves as a separate mitzvah. Any questions on that?
No.
Oh, gamatem. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to begin next week. Next week I'm going to be, you know, it's funny too, because I had something else I wanted to begin with today, and I didn't even get to it. The problem is, when you're preparing, I'd rather prepare too much rather than too little, because at least, you know, we'll have with something.
Wait,
go
Richie,
ahead.
You're not scheduled for next week. You're not scheduled
No, I'm sorry.
November
2 weeks 3rd. From today. 2 weeks from today. And I think the reason for not next week, is there a reason, Rebecca, are you there? I guess she had to go.
No, there must be
something
here.
With the assembly or something. It's not Martin Luther King, isn't that tomorrow?
No, it's International Holocaust Day, for what it's worth.
I don't think that's the reason why they didn't have it, because that's not, you know,
no,
you're
I
right,
know
you're
it's
absolutely
not
right. But whatever.
I don't remember why we decided not to do it that week.
I don't either. I mean, I would have no problem doing it, but then at this point, we've already set out the schedule. So I was going to, and I'll do this now because it's very interesting, and it's a good way to end with it. I'm going to begin next week with, do not count a mere negative statement among the prohibitions, and I'll explain what that means. I'm going to end with a concept that is in the Talmud. It's very, very, it's very interesting. You all know Marat Ayin. Marat Ayin, you do certain things, it will have the appearance of something that it may really not be, but still you're not supposed to do it because of the perception. You know, perception, how they say perception is everything. So the Talmud talks about the difference between Maris Ayin and Dan L'Hafzchut. So Dan L'Hafzchut, you're supposed to judge every man favorably. Some people go to great extremes not to, and some people go to great extremes too. But this is the example they give. I love the example. It says that if you see a person eating a meat meal and you see them what you think they're drinking milk with it, you have to assume it's coconut milk. Now, that is Dan L'Hafzchut. Marat Ayin It says if you personally are eating meat and you're drinking coconut milk, make sure the coconut shells are on the table.
That is, or in this case, soy milk.
Well, soy milk, right.
Or rice.
Well, what are you going to have? Soy, what do you, how can you serve it soy milk?
Yeah.
Well, actually, to make it contemporary, you would have the container, the soy milk container would have.
Biodegradable, of course. Biodegradable, of course.
Of course.
Right. Let me ask you, if any of you ever had soy milk, is it kosher?
Yes.
There are some that have a Heksher with a dairy mark on it, and I'm actually not, this is Penny, by the way, Penny Myers, I'm not exactly sure why. The Silk vanilla soy milk, my husband and I got into a lengthy discussion the other night about it, because there's a Heksher, but it's marked for dairy, and there's no dairy, there's nothing. It's, I mean, I can read the ingredients, it's quite interesting.
You know what, Penny, it's dairy equipment very often.
No. Well,
it was made on equipment that has also been used.
I was just going to say that.
No,
Neil.
That's right. You're right.
You beat me to it. The equipment would make the difference. But it's fascinating.
Well,
so I would say in contemporary, if soy milk were parav, which it isn't according to what you're saying, then you'd have to have when you're eating meat with that, you'd have to have the container there. But obviously, it doesn't. It's not applicable here.
But the rice milk, this is Linda Sue. This is the rice milk that we get is labeled as parav.
No kidding.
Yep.
And how does it taste?
I like it. It's sweeter than milk, but we have people in our household that are lactose intolerant, and so it's just but we're able to cook with it, and you know it is a nice way of being able to have something that that we can have it with any meal that we want.
That's excellent. Right. That sounds good. So I would say then if you have that, or if you had company, you'd let them know this is rice milk, and there's a heksher, and it's parav. You know,
exactly.
that would
but
be good.
We're actually facing this problem where I work in an assisted living facility. In our dining room, the residents have wanted fake bacon, which is OU heksher dairy. But how will we serve that? And we're debating now whether we can serve it and put notices on the tables as to what it is, because it would look to an outsider that, hey, they're not keeping kosher anymore.
Absolutely. But I think the average person is aware that they're vegetarian links and so on today. But you might be right. I mean, obviously, it would be nice so that nobody would think that. But your facility is considered kosher, isn't it?
Yes, we have an Orthodox mashgiach.
Well, there you go. So, you know, is it a mashgiach tamidi? Is he always there?
No, he pays surprise visits.
Yeah, right. They do that. That's very common. But I want to thank you all. If there's anybody that wants to remain, let me know, and I will be happy to stay on with you, especially if you wanted about last week. And
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Yasher koach.
Oh, you too. A good vach to you. Shavuot tov.
Nice job. Are we on for next week?
2 weeks, Benny. I'm sorry. I misspoke when I said it. I mean, I'd be happy to do next week, but it, the way the schedule is, it's now there's three more classes left for the 3rd, the 10th, and the 17th. Let me tell you, when I was asked to do this, I was asked, would you like three sessions or five sessions? I said five sessions. And I, you know, fortunately, it seems to be working out. But next week, for whatever reason, Benny, they didn't have the class. So it's going to be first three Sundays in February. You're going to be around, Benny?
Yes, I have it here. The third, 10th, and 17th.
The 3rd, the 10th, and 17th. Yeah.
Yep.
Is that what you said?
Yep.
Yeah, the 3rd, the 10th, and 17th. So we'll give you a rest next week. And but anybody, a few people said they couldn't get on the site on the our blog. What do you call it? The halacha blog that Rebecca.